Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more or attending the forum, point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more or to register. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this episode, number 97, we welcome University of Washington researcher Kate Starbird back into the Security Ledger studios to talk about her latest research, examining the web of bloggers, news websites, conspiracy theorists, and government actors who are targeting human rights workers in Syria. But first, the end times are upon us. This Friday, May 25th, marks the go-live date for the European Union's General Data Privacy Rule, or GDPR. Like a train that's been slowly coming down the track, GDPR's arrival has been anticipated for months, if not years. Still, only a small minority of firms say they're prepared to meet the regulation's stringent requirements to protect the data of EU citizens. That's especially true here in the US, where deregulatory fervor and a lack of a comprehensive national data privacy law have left consumers and the public at the mercy of ham-fisted data brokers. The latest example of that is LocationSmart, a third-party location tracking firm. It emerged last week in a series of stories by Krebs on Security, ZDNet, as well as Motherboard, which noted that the firm had made it possible to track the location of millions of U.S. mobile phone owners with nothing more than their cell phone number. The culprit, a vulnerable web-based application, but also a culture of lax data security and data privacy that has scared even the security researcher who discovered it. In our first segment, we speak with that researcher, Robert Zaw, a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon. To start off our conversation, I asked Robert about how he came to look at the LocationSmart web app and what he found.
My name is Robert Shaw. I'm a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University in the Human Computer Interaction Institute. I will be graduating very soon and starting as an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in computer science. I saw a recent news article from ZDNet saying that somebody using the Securus web interface had been improperly accessing call records. And in the article, they mentioned this company called LocationSmart. And they said, hey, LocationSmart's got this web demo where you can, you know, punch in a number, it'll phone you, and then, you know, once you give consent, it'll track your location. And I thought to myself, hey, this is interesting. Punch in any number, and, you know, it'll just, with a simple call or text, it's going to track that number. I wonder if that call or text is actually strictly necessary. So I started digging into their website, and I looked around, and within 15 minutes of me, they're going onto the site and looking around, I found what looked like a real security vulnerability. So that's sort of when the floor dropped out, in some sense, when I discovered that this was really a much bigger issue. This free tool, basically, how it was intended to work was you would sign on, you would punch in a number, you'd say, track my mobile, it would send you an SMS or a phone call, you would reply to that phone call, and then they would start showing you your location on this website. And what I found was that you could actually just skip the consent part entirely, and you could track anyone's phone without any sort of consent being given. Mm.
So talk about how you were able to do that and where their security model, such as it was, broke down.
So the basic gist was I discovered that by essentially modifying the stream of requests that they were making to their internal API, so that, you know, their website sort of has a feature on it that lets you track these phones, and it's supported in the back end by this programming interface, this API. And I found that by modifying the stream of requests going to that API, you could just simply omit the part where it asked for consent, and then secondarily trick the programming interface into believing that consent had already been given. And so by combining those two parts together, it was essentially possible to simply punch in a 10-digit phone number and get that phone's location without that phone ever knowing, without the owner of that phone ever knowing that their location was being tracked. That's basically it.
Just to understand, LocationSmart is kind of a reseller of this data, and the data is obtained from the major wireless networking providers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, and so on. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. And that list also includes TELUS and Bell up in Canada. My understanding of this is that they obtain the data from their so-called wireless partners, and then upon request, we'll give it to anybody who asks very nicely. And this has been going on for years.
Man, where do we even start with this? So some of the stories that have been published have shown how law enforcement has been using this data in some cases, obviously to identify or track suspects. But presumably, it isn't just being sold or resold for the public good, public safety. Really, anyone with a bank account can get this data. Is that accurate?
My understanding is that they will sell to marketers who they claim, you know, they'll check that the marketers have obtained consent. But my research demonstrates how weak that consent can possibly be. And for things like roadside assistance, for things like E911, et cetera, those are things that essentially they sell the data for any location-enabled purpose. The only bar they have is that they claim that they require either a law enforcement reason or informed consent, neither of which, in my case, are applicable.
This informed consent, I mean, as we understand it, is that them basically saying, well, you'll get a text message and you'll have to approve the sharing of your location data? Is that what they mean by informed consent, or is there more behind it than we're seeing?
In their location demo, that's the case. In some of the applications that they tout, that's the case. But that doesn't always have to be the case. Imagine, for example, downloading a free game off of Google Play or something that contains within its terms and conditions, we'll track your location and sell it to third parties, right? And that's considered informed consent as well, because it's a terms and conditions that you sign up for. So that's, you know, the terms that they apply can be extremely broad. And, you know, you would have no indication essentially that some random thing you downloaded that was tracking your location through this. Although, as demonstrated, you know, you don't have to be compromised by some semi-malware spyware app to have your location tracked all the time without consent.
And this application that they've developed, is this more or less the back end to all of these tracking services? In other words, would their business partners be linking their own applications back to this web application that you found these vulnerabilities in?
That would be my expectation, yes. The companies that, you know, are LocationSmart's customers effectively would be using such a kind of programming interface, yeah,
right,
to access location data. Although presumably, you know, they would have, you know, access to bulk location data, for example, you know, being able to ask for, you know, thousands of phone numbers at the same time.
And this particular flaw that you found, it seemed to key on what format you requested the data to be returned in, whether it was returned in a JSON format or XML format,
I guess. Format, right.
Yeah. Any idea how that happened?
This is a kind of an elementary data validation failure. And my guess is basically, you know, they said, okay, well, our for the purposes of this demo, we've got to code in this thing that requests a subscription. And so the, you know, whoever implemented this went off and duly said, okay, we'll add the validation to, you know, to the status request, and then we'll sort of add this validation to this, you know, to the location request. But they probably only added that to the side of it that was used by the actual interface, the web interface, and they forgot to check that it also would apply to the JSON request, because that was an unused feature of their programming interface. And this is a fairly common kind of bug, you know, essentially unused features that are exposed to remote users, to remote attackers, are very, very frequently the source of bugs, because those are untested, unintentionally exposed to the wider internet and to users. And essentially, very, very frequently, the kinds of bugs that you would expect can lurk in those kinds of things. So I, you know, when I do security testing, I often will look for sort of unused features like that, or sort of unintentionally exposed interfaces like that.
And in this case, how were you able to discover it?
I was able to discover this by basically looking at the request, capturing the request, and then modifying those requests as they were being sent, and seeing how the server responded to modified versions of my requests. So, you know, one of my modifications was to basically change the format. And then I discovered that essentially when I changed the format and then requested a phone number that hadn't been authorized through the API, that it was still returning location information rather than returning a failure message. And that's when I realized that this bug was completely exploitable. At that point, you know, I reached out and got a little bit more validation from people I knew, and then sort of tried to break this open. It's quite frightening. I mean,
you could have plugged in really any phone number at that point and been able to track its location.
Literally any phone number. Yeah. Literally any phone number. I was sort of on a big email thread with people from US CERT trying to validate essentially what was going on and trying to figure out what was going on. And they would just give me, they'd say, okay, well, we just got a bunch of people together in a room, or rather we got a bunch of people together that we know, you know, here's six phone numbers, go off and then test them. And I'd go bang, 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 bang. Here's your addresses, you know, and in most cases, those are accurate to within 200 to 400 feet. And it was working for basically any number I would punch in. Yeah. So it really was sort of panopticon.
Gosh, it just seems like there's this kind of weakest link phenomena that happens with so many of these tracking applications where, you know, even if the application that is collecting the data is secure, and we don't actually even know if that's true in this case, down the chain, there's a weak link, and whether that's on the back end or in transit or what have you, and the data kind of just gets barfed out.
Right. The fundamental problem here is that this company has access to data in the first place. This is the kind of data that should be treated with high levels of security, you know, that isn't just handed out willy-nilly to third parties and then resold ad infinitum. This is the kind of thing that needs to be sort of very carefully safeguarded. I think the locational privacy of, you know, upwards of 200 million Americans here was just open to anybody through a very simple interface. And that should, you know, even if that was a secured endpoint, who knows when hackers might have breached the actual, you know, website? Who knows when a disgruntled insider would just run off with the API keys? These are the kinds of things that you do not want to trust to, you know, to some third party to resell and to sort of trust their word that they will be secure about it. This is the kind of thing that we need to be keeping absolutely, well, ideally that there will be laws to actually protect the privacy of this information.
Do we know how long this test application was up and running on the website?
The Internet Archive demonstrates that it was up from at least January 2017. So that's what, like 16 months. But their internal documents on the website suggest that there's a screenshot of a version of that website from September of 2016. So it's been probably 18 months, maybe longer. And who knows how long it was up before then. And this is something that anyone could have gotten to just by filling out a contact form and going to the URL. So it could have been open for 18 months. It could have been open for many more years than that. Who knows? So I have not contacted the company, to be very, very clear. I coordinated disclosure through US CERT. And when the vulnerability was patched, then I coordinated with Brian Krebs to break the story.
But the problem, at least the one that you identified, has been fixed.
They fixed it by taking down the entire feature, yes.
And again, this is a pretty cursory review by you. There could well have been additional vulnerabilities either for the demo app or the actual app that we just don't know about.
Just to give you an idea, I did find other vulnerabilities already that could be chained into something bigger. For example, the application would hand out tokens that would identify your session, and those tokens were not random. Those tokens were based on the system timestamp. And so they were highly predictable, and a predictable token means that it would be possible to essentially eavesdrop or hijack another person's session. So that's another vulnerability. I don't mention that sort of publicly because, you know, it's overshadowed by sort of the primary one. But who knows how many more bugs like that could have been lurking in the code. And these are just things that I found with a cursory review of the code, of the system. You know, they're not even the only location provider. So it's not even clear how many other location providers could have bugs like this in their systems. You know, this is a real wake-up call, I think. You know, honestly, this whole episode is a little bit, it was a bit of a shock to me, really, that I would have assumed that in a functioning sort of a tech economy, that this kind of thing wouldn't be possible. But instead, I find that the telecom companies are happy to sell their data, this private location data, to these third-party resellers. These third-party resellers are happy to sell it down the road. And there doesn't seem to be anybody in charge here, anybody sort of looking at this and saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something totally, totally wrong with this situation.
Yeah.
And that's what really worries me, is basically, this bug is one thing, right? This bug is clearly a big issue that has been potentially violating people's privacy for a long time, but it's a bug. How many more of those are out there? Software bugs are rampant in the industry, right? And these companies are not taking that seriously, I don't think. You know, and the telecom companies certainly aren't taking this seriously enough, I don't think. This is a real wake-up call. This is one of those things that I think, you know, if people don't start paying attention to this now, we're just going to see much more severe violations of people's privacy down the road. This is part of the privacy erosion. And this needs to, in my opinion, this needs to stop. Just imagine, you know, till this vulnerability was fixed, I had the ability to punch in any U.S. person's or a Canadian person's 10-digit mobile phone number and find out exactly where they were to within 200 feet of their current location in real time. I could watch people drive around. I had a friend, he's driving around Hawaii. I could watch him driving around the island. I mean, that's just completely unacceptable to me, completely frightening to me. The data should not be out there. That data should just not be out there at all. I really, really, admire the European approach. This, the GDPR stuff. I know it's almost like the GDPR apocalypse for companies, but you know, people at least who deal with European citizens are now having to take privacy and security much more seriously because there are real consequences for messing up. And I think that is a very good approach. I don't know if the same thing will work here. But I think we need to start exploring things like that. We need to start exploring things like real consequences for exposing people's private information. We need to explore things like making sure that certain classes of private information are just not available or, you know, are tightly controlled from the outset. Yeah, until we start caring about that as a nation, I guess, you know, it's hard to see how the change will happen.
Robert Jha, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on the Security Ledger podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for this interview. Yeah, I'm happy to chat anytime.
Up next, last week brought news of another mass shooting inside a U.S. high school, this one at Santa Fe High School in Texas. While news anchors, parents, and students reacted in shock and horror over the carnage, online, a quieter campaign was afoot. This one to deny the essential truth of the shooting, in part by portraying its victims as crisis actors hired to confuse the public. Figuring out how such online rumors get started is the specialty of our next guest, Kate Starbird of the University of Washington, whose expertise is crisis informatics. I invited Kate back into the Security Ledger studios to talk about the online rumors linked to the Santa Fe shooting and her group's latest research on information sharing between disparate groups who are targeting so-called white helmet human rights workers in Syria. To start out, Kate and I talked about the recent shooting and the rapid appearance of false narratives concerning the shooting in the hours after it occurred.
Yeah, my name is Kate Starbird. I am an assistant professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Human-Centered Design and Engineering. Yeah, so this is what we've sort of been studying for years now in our lab. We started out just looking at social media use after or during and after crisis events of different kinds. And then especially for the man-made crisis events and very much for the shooting events, we were seeing this activity, this online activity to produce and spread these narratives that were saying that these events either hadn't happened or they hadn't happened in the way that the media was telling you they were happening, and that they were either false flag events or they were events that were staged by crisis actors with varying meanings behind why someone might stage these events. But a lot of the accusations were that the U.S. government, now they would say the deep state as opposed to the government, but the U.S. government was staging these events in order to, for some sort of political motive about usually taking away guns. So as if these events, these shooting events are staged as with the goal of gun control or other kinds of motivations that they would ascribe to the people that they said were perpetrating these events. It's kind of convoluted, but in the last couple months, in the last 6 or 8 months, this idea of the crisis actors narrative has become a lot more salient. I think a lot of people around have now heard of this, but we've been seeing this for years in our data sets different people with different goals try to leverage these events for political motives. And one of the things specifically that folks of the alt-right, and I put that in quotation marks, it's their term, some of the things that the alt-right have done in recent years is to try to very quickly get ahead of the narrative, get ahead of the story, and start saying that the perpetrator was a supporter of left-leaning causes or was Antifa or whatever, or something similar.
Yeah.
So they manufacture that evidence very quickly. They'll put up fake profiles. They'll doctor pictures and other things to essentially create these false narratives. And the goal of some of these false narratives isn't that everyone's going to converge onto these narratives, but if you can get out ahead, you can actually affect how people see this, even though that narrative might get corrected. That person that saw it may never forget that the suspect has been associated with those kinds of political causes. And also just to confuse the space. The whole goal of a lot of this kind of these information wars, the whole goal is to confuse the space. And so people just start losing trust in what they're seeing. And if their main goal is that the media lies to you, by propagating these narratives and event and occasionally getting them amplified by what we now might think of as media, although a lot of the sites that would amplify this stuff aren't mainstream, just by getting that amplified, it just continues to confuse the space and contributes to people losing trust in information.
Your latest research focused on Syria and some of the organized efforts, online efforts to change the narrative or influence the narrative about what is happening in Syria, in particular related to these Syrian humanitarian workers, so-called white helmets. How did you and your research team decide to focus on that in particular? And how did you go about researching this?
Yeah, so there's a couple of reasons that we started focusing on the white helmets as a topic for our investigations and for our research. One of those is that we've long been looking at the use of social media during disaster events. And part of the disaster landscape is humanitarian response and humanitarian response groups. And so we have collaborators in different places. But in this research, we have collaborators at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative who were interested in seeing how humanitarian response organizations were the target of disinformation campaigns. And this has happened in other places as well. We've seen that happen with health workers who are delivering vaccines, have been targeted with disinformation and conspiracy theories, and even murdered based on some of those in other kinds of places and other kinds of situations. And so we picked the white helmets because we knew there was a lot of conversation about them in some of the online spaces. We'd seen the intersection in our own research between the white helmets conversations and the accusations of crisis actors. And we'd been studying the crisis actor claims related to shooting events. And so it was some of the same language, the same narratives that were being spread to undermine the white helmets had been the same narratives used after these shooting events to claim that they weren't happening in the way that we were seeing them happen. And so there were both these connections in terms of the websites, the accounts, and the language that we were looking at in this other context, as well as this interest just generally in humanitarian response, which our research has looked at in the past.
One of the things I found interesting in the data that you collected about the Syrian white helmets was that there was a pretty significant role that state-sponsored media was playing in the disinformation system. I think we tend to think about this as, you know, rogue actors or groups who are maybe loosely affiliated. But in this case, for the Syrian stories, RT and Sputnik and so on were big sources of the information that was being pumped out, the inaccurate information about these white helmets.
Yeah, so you can look at this space in a couple of different ways. If we look structurally at the different websites that are involved in the production of content as well as their sort of sharing of content across those websites, you actually get these two different spheres of activity around the white helmets. And one is sort of in the mainstream media, the Western-facing media, and they're producing content that is largely supportive of the white helmets and talks about them as, you know, humanitarian responders and notes, you know, the casualties that they've suffered and things like that. And then, and it's actually in the data we've seen, it's very small in terms of activity. They are having reach perhaps through their articles, but in terms of the tweet activity around them during the time period we were looking at was pretty small. And then we had this much bigger sphere of activity that is what people would what these websites call themselves, alternative media. And in that sphere, integrated into that sphere, were sites like RT, Sputnik, Press TV, which is an Iranian government funded and connected site, and some others that are associated with other kinds of state actors. And so the sphere that called itself alternative media was highly integrated with these government funded sites. The people that get their media from inside this alternative media sphere talk about themselves as being independent and alternative, and yet they're integrated with government-funded sites that have interest in a conflict that's happening in Syria for which the White Helmets represent a threat to their interests.
When you look at this graph, and there's a really cool kind of Twitter graph of the tweet traffic going back and forth, some of the big kind of nodes in this are sites that you probably haven't heard of, you know, 21st Century Wire, Mint Press News. What are these sites? What is their function and what do we know about them?
So there's actually a lot of different kinds of sites in here. 21st Century Wire is a good one to start with in this conversation because they're producing the largest volume of original content in terms of the articles that are being cited by people on Twitter and elsewhere. 21st Century Wire is the website right now that's hosting a lot of that content. Originally, it gets published there and then it gets shared elsewhere in the alternative media. There's a lot of content sharing that happens. So 21st Century Wire is essentially, it is a little bit what it says. It's suggesting that it's sort of a news wire, kind of like the AP, but it's a news wire for the modern era. And they are producing content and they're allowing people to share their content with different kinds of arrangements. We actually don't know what the financial arrangements are for how they share their content. But they're talking about themselves as sort of an AP. This site is fascinating because it appears also in our earlier research on conspiracy theories of crisis events, where they were propagating claims that the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting was not as it seemed. They also spread a lot of other kinds of different kinds of conspiratorial content. If you go to that site, they had content from everything from aliens to claims that George Soros is responsible for everything nasty in the world to sort of anti-Semitic themes. They just had a lot of different kinds of conspiracy theories there. What they are sort of both a catch-all for all sorts of alternative media, and in this particular conversation, they've become a leading voice for spreading content that is critical of the White Helmets and spread certain narratives that align with Syrian government and Russian government interests in Syria. So it's both a conspiracy theory site and a site that is, you know, carrying some specific geopolitical narratives. Mint Press News is a very different kind of site. I'm not going to go in and unpack it. There have been some really interesting investigative journalism pieces about what that site is, who they're associated with, and what their goals are. But their position is sort of a U.S. left-leaning site, and yet they also echo a lot of pro-Iranian and pro-Russian narratives and have a very specific orientation in this conversation that is critical of the White Helmets and particularly any sort of U.S. or NATO kind of interests in Syria. And then Global Research is a longstanding, far left, what we would, some people might call alt-left, but it's a longstanding far left think tank that has spread lots of conspiracy theories, including about 9/11 and other kinds of things, that has been an amplifier of Russian and Kremlin funded narratives since for a long time, many years.
In some ways, it's a way of whitewashing some of these stories and making them seem as if they've passed the editorial sniff test of a legitimate site.
What you've got is information laundering. Yes. So if we think of like financial money laundering, we've got a lot of information laundering here.
One of the points that you make, and I know this point was made when we spoke before, was that conventional left-right distinctions. You know, in the U.S., we think about conservative versus liberal, right-leaning versus left-leaning news outlets, publications, and so on. That really breaks down in this alternative news ecosystem, or as some might call it, fake news ecosystem, that you can find both right-wing and left-wing sites grabbing on to the same information and re-amplifying it.
It's a really interesting dynamic. One thing we can't work out is the causation, but we can look and see these different kinds of sites that are everything from sort of libertarian to alt-right to far left are all amplifying the same content. In some cases, the same article will appear on something from like truepatriot.net and Activist Post and the Mint Press News, right? And so Mint Press News is supposed to be left. We've got truepatriot.net, which is clearly targeted towards a different kind of audience, and Activist Post, which is a place where these things kind of intersect pretty strongly. So we've got the same content appearing in very different kinds of packages. And so I'm not sure whether those groups are converging under the same ideas or if they're being micro-targeted with messages that are trying to pull them together and getting pulled towards these other narratives that connect these websites together that otherwise just you wouldn't understand how they would be in the same information space.
When you read your report, and I'm probably going to way oversimplify things here, but just go with me on this. And particularly, even if you look at the graphics that you guys put together, the kind of link analysis of the Twitter activity and so on, the impression that you get is that it is not necessarily that the alternative media is bigger than the traditional media, but it's a heck of a lot louder. That the intensity of the sharing and resharing and tweeting and retweeting seems like exponentially larger than anything you see in the sort of, you know, graph that you guys have of what we would recognize as kind of more the traditional media, you know, the Associated Press and New York Times and Washington Post and these types of traditional media outlets.
You've characterized it really well in the sense that mainstream media is covering these stories, alternative media is covering these stories, and the number of articles may actually be pretty comparable. But the conversations that are happening online, especially on Twitter in this case, but we can think about them happening in other places online as well, we believe they are, they are more active. The anti-white helmets voices are more active on social media during this period of time that we were studying it. We're going to extend that to the next year to see if this kind of trend holds out. But that activity for me represents what I think is an information kind of activism. I see this, there are online activists. Some of these folks are government agents, but a lot of these folks are not. A lot of these folks are people that feel passionate about this topic, and they are very active. They tweet a lot. They go find this content on these websites, and they tweet it and they retweet each other and they pass the information around, and they target people who don't support their voices for different kinds of activities that some might call trolling, but they're very eager to, you know, go call out people that are supportive of the white helmets and call them out. So they're actually doing all sorts of this sort of information activism online. Around criticizing the white helmets and essentially supporting the Syrian government, the Assad-led Syrian government, and the Russian government's interest in this conflict.
Is it also just that, you know, they're quite good at the art of promoting things online, whereas maybe you know, more traditional media are obviously keep a lower profile and are less out there, but maybe just not as good at promoting their narrative?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate, it's an accurate description. I think right now that what we see, they've got some very sophisticated techniques for how they're sharing information, how they're organizing around that information, and how they're, amplifying different narratives, supporting each other, targeting others for certain kinds of attacks. They've been very good at silencing opposition through just sort of harassment behavior. And they probably wouldn't call it that. They probably call it mobilizing. But I've studied online activism in crisis response for a long time, and I've begun to think of this group as as a group of online activists who, in this case, it's they're activating for a political cause, and there many of them are sincere believers, and yet there are others that are infiltrated or integrated into their group are probably agents of information agents of different kinds, and we've seen some evidence of that as well. And they're working together in this very kind of complex online organizing, and they're very good at what they do. If you think of disinformation, especially Kremlin-led disinformation, as a long game, which we are learning it has been a long game. Some of these accounts and websites have been around for a long time, in whether an online form or other kind of form. The ideas underneath them have been around for a long time. The narratives that they have are old narratives from the Kremlin. They're not brand new. You know, even if they echo Kremlin narratives, many of these things, they've become ideologies for people. And so it's very hard to disentangle what is Russian-led disinformation, what is Russian-led disinformation, you know, now in sense of like it's being coordinated or being pumped into the system, versus these are just people and entities that have begun to share this ideology of that believes that, you know, the U.S. and NATO are aggressors in all these conflicts, and the mainstream media is lying all the time. And a lot of this criticism that they're basing this on, a lot of this has, you know, we have a long history in this world of some of this is built around ideas that a lot of people share. And so it's hard to disentangle, like, what is like true criticism of mainstream media, true criticism of those that are trying to respond to this event or this event, to this conflict, or trying to make different kinds of changes in this conflict, versus disinformation narratives that are trying to amplify different parts of this to undermine some interests in favor of others. It's really hard to disentangle. And so it really depends on your definition of organic. You could see maybe you can see it all as sort of a disinformation campaign, but you can also see that very little of it is probably coordinated in the day-to-day from the, you know, Russian government or Iranian government agents. They're part of this system, but they're not necessarily pulling all the strings. They're nudging it in really interesting ways, though. It's cultivated. Pieces of it are orchestrated, but we can't necessarily distinguish the difference between the orchestration and the organic. But it's certainly cultivated, and it's not just cultivated this week. It's been cultivated for a long time.
You know, if we live in a world now where, again, information flows so fluidly and seamlessly around the world, where there's very little filter between people and information, and where you have this concerted effort to present alternate realities, you know, even just as bald as, you know, the shooting happened. No, the shooting didn't happen. You know, the plane crashed. No, it didn't crash, you know, and just kind of questioning the fabric of reality. You know, did this thing that I'm hearing about happen or did it not? And if I want to believe that it didn't happen, there's actually this whole, you know, as you call it, ecosystem of sites that are willing to reinforce that idea and provide a lot of what seems like evidence to support it. So if you're an organization or a society that has an investment in facts and the truth, how do you counter that?
Well, it's a complex problem. It's got multiple pieces. And I think we can approach it from a couple of different ways. We can look at the platforms that are mediating this content. And I think that there's a role for them to play in figuring out how to do a better job. I think the technological systems can alter their affordances to, you know, reduce harassment, reduce amplification, reduce actors who are pretending to be somebody else from spreading different kinds of messages. I think there's a large role that it can play, at least from being gamed. A lot of the platforms have been gamed to promote some of this, the worst content during these events. And I think they've recognized that, and they're going to address those problems. And so there are a few things they can do. The hard thing is, how do we as a society address this problem and still preserve our values about censorship and our values about freedom of speech and these different kinds of things? And so there's some hard questions for platforms, and even if the government were going to try to regulate something, there'd be really hard questions there. There's also a role, and this is the role that I think that we've been trying to address or possibly play in in education, in educating society about understanding what's going on, to understand better that, you know, when I go into this, you know, when I go to do my research in some of these online spaces, that a lot of that can lead me into places where people are motivated to look like someone that they're not and to spread certain kind of messages. And if we could learn how to recognize that technique, my hope is, we don't have evidence that it's going to work yet, but my hope is that we can do a better job of protecting ourselves from engaging with this content and from being manipulated by it. And the problem is that even when we know what we're seeing, it can manipulate us. Even if we hear later that it wasn't true, it's already changed our opinion of what we saw. Yeah. So, for instance, the photographs of the Parkland kids, the kids that have become activists afterwards, some of the photographs of them have been altered in ways that are designed to make us feel very negative to lead towards them. And we can't undo that once we've seen it. So the trick is, how do we begin to recognize this stuff and learn not to engage with it? And I think that there's a role for education, both in schools and especially out of schools. I think this isn't a K-12 problem or an undergraduate problem. This is a K-99 problem. It's all of us.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of times the sort of the challenge that the conspiracy theorist or the, you know, the sort of false narrative peddler puts to people who are skeptical is, oh, you know, do the research, you know, do your own, you know, do it, research it on your own, look on your own, you know, sort of saying, I'm not going to be involved, you go find it on your own. But of course, as we know, by searching for certain topics, you are basically opening the door into this whole bazaar of alternative narratives. So just sort of saying, research it on your own is kind of an invitation to say, here, come, you know, kind of take the pill with me and go on the journey.
Yeah. And they say, you know, you'll be a critical thinker. Yeah. Come here and do your own research. You're a critical thinker. We're just going to give you the facts. And yet they give you very certain sets of facts shaped into very certain kinds of narratives. And they do it in a way that the reason we did this one study that in this way, this first paper, was that we kept going into this space and we said, gosh, all these different websites are talking about this same thing. Maybe there's something here. And then you realize it's the same content just being copied and pasted in all these different places. And once you realize that it's not independent content, you're not getting 1,000 different scientists saying climate change is wrong. You're getting the same scientists copied in 1,000 places. And so it's tricking our cognitive systems, our cognitive processes for making sense of information are being tricked by this, you know, ability to see the same information, but packaged in all these different places. And so until we learn to recognize that, or at least to disengage with that, we've got,
And that's one of the really interesting things you guys did was to take that, to kind of trace back to those original sources and try and figure out where this stuff came from and then how it got recopied and reused, you know, over and over and over again by these different sites.
Yeah, it's giving us, we had this idea from the first study we did that we're getting this sense of false triangulation, and then we went and we did the analysis and sure enough, there's this, the same content is appearing in all these different places, and our brain thinks, oh, I saw it there and I saw it this other place, and I saw it this third time in this totally different site.
Yeah.
This must be true. Reality, same content.
All right,
content.
Kate Starbird, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Cool. Thank you.